state it flat out, like, you're not always going to be in the mood for prayer, and you're not always going to, and it should always be considered a kind of holy work, and vice versa. Can you extrapolate that out a bit?
I love that point. I could talk for hours about this, because it's near and dear to my heart. So first of all, you're absolutely right. Not only can prayer oftentimes be a lot of work, or it can be boring, or you can feel like you're just praying into the void and nobody's hearing and there's nobody out there. It can be frustrating if you're praying for something, and in particular, like the health of your mother, and her health's not improving. So there's lots of that kind of stuff on that first level of that makes it just. And then on the next level up is that prayer, by its very nature, is something that brings us in contact with ourselves as well. It reminds me of, there was an article in the New York Times about Mepkin Abbey, and they went down and they interviewed a bunch of retreatants, and all these retreatants were talking about how wonderful and beautiful and quiet and a place is, and tranquil, and it is. And finally they interviewed this businessman, and he said, yeah, it's quiet and it's tranquil, all right. He said, but when you're sitting on a park bench overlooking the Cooper River for hours on end, you find yourself thinking about things you'd rather not think about. So prayer can also be a terrifying, terrifying thing, because right. You begin to encounter those things in yourself that you've been avoiding. You've been using distractions. You know, we're also not just getting back to the sacraments. The alcohol sales are up 30% since the lockdown. So when people are forced to come to terms with themselves, I had an experience he was an executive at, his name was Jim at the time, he became Brother Benedict, but he was an executive at Columbia University, and he became a monk. And first time I met him at work, I actually met him at work, and I stuck out my hand. He knew who I was, I knew who he was, and I stuck out my hand, and I said, how you doing, Jim? And Augie and Jim, I said, how's it going so far? And he was a novice, and he said, it's hard, and it's so much harder than I thought it was going to be. And I said, for instance, and he took his hand as if it was a mirror and he put it right at the end of his nose. And he said, I'm right here all the time. There's nowhere to run and there's nowhere to hide. He said, I thought I left all my demons in New York, but I guess I brought them along with me. And he laughed. And part of the difficulty, and I've lived 3 or 4 months at a time as a Trappist monk, as a part-time Trappist monk. And part of the difficulty, and that's what the life is designed to do. It's not an accident. It's designed to leave you with nothing to think, to take all the distractions away, so that you're it's you and God and yourself, right? And right. And that can be a very scary place you don't want to go to. Right. And so that's the third thing is that the next level up for me in the terms of work in prayer and prayer's work is that the monks believe in St. Paul, learn to pray always. So there's two aspects in which the work itself is actually prayer. First of all, I just mentioned one, right? You can do your work with a prayerful attitude. I went to Catholic school, you know, and every darn, and I mentioned this in my book, as a matter of fact, so every darn time that we'd complain about anything, what would the nuns would say? Offer it up.
Yeah.
Offer it up. So I didn't know what the hell that meant when I was a kid, but But you can offer it up. So the monks are offering up their actual physical labor that they're doing. That's an offering to God. It's a form of prayer. And then finally, the thing that I noticed is that you bring your prayer to work with you. In other words, I would find myself at work, and I would find myself praying. Right. And or I would be contemplating some reading from vigils that morning, or sometimes it's kind of trivial for me to even mention this, but the noonday prayer at Mepkin Abbey, there's a little hymn. That's almost unless on holidays, you always do it. Blessed are the poor in heart, for they shall see our God. You know, and I would find myself at work, just this hymn would just be going over and over and over in my mind. And rather than it just being some kind of a ditty like you'd hear on the radio or something, I would be getting deeper into it. What is, you know, I don't really want to intellectualize it by saying, what does it mean to be pure of heart? But it, in the sense that that's what was happening.
Right.
And so there's a whole, there's a, it's all part of praying in every aspect, making your life a prayer. I remember I asked one of my teachers, my spiritual directors, way back when I was 20 years old. I said, Father, what do you think of prayer? And he said, make your life a prayer. It'll be answered instantly.
Yeah. So the idea of walking liturgy, walking worship, walking consecration is one that, like we said earlier, traditional minded people aren't necessarily so comfortable with. But I've always said this. I think I said it at my school once. I was chastened for not stopping what I was doing to pray in the morning. And it's kind of just a you know, it's not a particularly profound high school Catholic prayer. I was continuing to work, and I said, you know, well, there's ora et labora. And of course, I ended up explaining what that meant, that it's easier, like G.K. Chesterton said, to strike the right mental state by striking the right posture, you know, hitting the knees is best to do at least once a day. But other times we're offering up our work as a form of prayer and vice versa. And we're offering up, like you just said, even our lives as a form of liturgy. And that can get a little squishy a little quick, but the Trappist monks seem to get it. And the proof is in not just their high profit margin, it's in the telos, the goal, the purpose that underlies the high profit margin. And that's really what people I think are missing about free enterprise. Is it not? Is that it's you're blaming the messenger.
Well, there's so many mistakes that are made. First of all, the vast majority of people, and unfortunately, the vast majority of Catholics think that free enterprise is a zero-sum game. I don't care even if they say intellectually they don't believe it. They really believe that. They believe that the only way I can make more money is to take money away from you. The only way I can get rich is to make you poor. The only way I can be successful is to exploit you. That's not true. I remember Lewis Mobley, you know, had a very simple analogy. He said, imagine that I have a tie that you like and you want my tie and you offer me $20 and I give you my tie. Well, first of all, it has to be a free exchange, which in this case it is. He said that. What does that mean? He says that means that you want my tie more than you want your $20. Mm-hmm. And I want your $20 more than I want my tie. He said, we both go away happier than we were when we met. There has been a net increase in value in the universe because of this. And so it's a win-win-win all the way around. And that's the way a free enterprise is supposed to work when it's working at its best.
Let me just jump in here to add to this timeless perennial principle. When you talk about something like eminent domain, the government forcing people to give up their land because of the so-called holdout problem. You know, they want to build a highway through a neighborhood. And they, unlike private industry, unlike private businesses, they can force you off your land. And they just say, you know, we'll give you whatever the market value is. And they use some metric for market value for your property. So this isn't highway robbery, no pun intended. The problem with this reasoning is, in terms of actual value, you as a homeowner have whatever that market value is that you're being forced off your land to accept. You already know that that's the market value, and you've been sustainedly passing, meaning not accepting that value for your land. You would rather have your land itself. So when you're
That means you have a higher value for the land than the market is valuing for it right now.
Precisely.
And you have every right to feel that way. I mean, to be that way.
Right.
You know, I used to laugh at my grandfather. Well, not laugh really, but I used to kind of smile at my grandfather and my father because my grandfather was a Slovak immigrant. And his attitude was that if you offered him $5 for anything, you must know something he doesn't know. It must really be worth $6. Mm-hmm. So he would say no. So you'd say, oh, all right, I'll give you $6. Now he really thinks you know something he doesn't know. So now you offer him 10, and all you've done there now is you've convinced him that you really know something that he doesn't know. So they never were able to sell anything. Now my father and my grandfather never seemed to be able to sell anything. But I agree with you. But the other thing I wanted to comment on is that getting back to quality versus quantity, the thing that we miss, which I spend a lot of time discussing in my book, is the idea of formation. And formation is not education. You know, we think that, what Lou Mobley was just absolutely adamant about, it goes back to Socrates, can virtue be taught? You know, leadership cannot be taught.